behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Lisa Thomas and a trustee of the World Affairs Council and your moderator for this evening's program. It's now my great pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. Rumida Navai is a British-Iranian foreign affairs journalist who has reported from over 30 countries, including South Sudan, Afghanistan, Egypt, Nigeria, El Salvador, and Zimbabwe. She has made 20 documentaries for Channel 4's series Unreported World, and she was awarded an Emmy for her undercover report from Syria for PBS's Frontline. She has worked as a journalist for the United Nations in Pakistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, Iran, and was the Tehran correspondent for The Times from 2003 to 2006. She has just authored the book, City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death, and the Search for Truth in Tehran. Please join me in welcoming Rumida Navai. Thank you. Before we get started, I have to say it's not only is it a pleasure, but it's a little intimidating to be in my seat with such an esteemed journalist, and in particular someone who has based her book on interviews. So I'm hoping that in the course of the next hour, we can have a great conversation, learn a little bit more about the book, learn a little bit more about Tehran and Iran, life in the country, as well as a little bit more about you.
Hopefully you won't feel how I feel as an interviewer sometimes. I get very frustrated that I'm not giving you the right answers.
Okay. Well, thank you. And go easy on me then, if you will. So let's start with the book. The book is 8 very detailed and rich chapters, each telling the story of a different Iranian. And it paints an interesting portrait of Iran and its people, with a compelling view that people are leading double lives, a public life and a private life. A place where you say where truth has become a secret. How has it become that such a hypocrisy, or that lying has become such a way of life for most people in Iran?
Well, first of all, I want to make it clear that I'm not saying that Iranians are congenital liars. I think there's an aspect of this which can be seen positively, that Iranians are really adaptable, resilient people. And one of the reasons they lie is because they, of course not everybody lies, but one of the reasons they lie is because they are determined to live the lives that they want to live, not the lives that they are told they must live, either because of the law or because of judgment from society. And because of 30 years of the Islamic regime, it's been interesting to see how people have adapted to 30 years of the Islamic regime, and to see how this has spawned this kind of dual life, this double life of some Iranians, that there is the private inside life that's usually quite different from the public outside life.
So the idea of the book came about when you were working as a journalist in 2004. Walk us through sort of how you came to the idea of the book and how you met the individuals that you interviewed and the stories that you were hearing, I guess, to begin to patch together these composite figures.
So when I was working as a journalist, I was monitored by the intelligence services, as most Iranian journalists are. Actually, I don't know about most, but certainly lots of the Iranian journalists I spoke to had similar experiences to me. And it's not always a very lovely experience. It's meant to intimidate, and it does intimidate you. And everybody knows the red lines. You have to be careful. Even Western journalists self-censored to a degree. They knew what they couldn't write about. Every now and again, a Western journalist was chucked out the country for crossing the boundaries, and of course, journalists are always pushing the boundaries. And I got off pretty lightly because Iranian journalists, there are some who are in and out of prison. So I had my press card revoked, and usually they don't tell you why you have your press card revoked. But in my case, they did. There was a pretty friendly official at the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, who was the ministry that oversaw us journalists working for foreign media. And I was told that I had done two things to piss them off. I had covered the human rights case, and it was the case of an original revolutionary, a guy who fought for the revolution, who had been pro-regime, who had been close to Ayatollah Khomeini, actually. And he turned against the regime, and he'd started speaking out about against the supreme leader and against the system, and he'd been imprisoned and he was on hunger strike. And this hadn't gone down too well with them. I'd also written about a film. It's a cult classic now. It's called Marmoulak, the Lizard. And it's about a convict who escapes from prison dressed up as a mullah, and there's a scene in it where he's standing on the side of the road trying to hail a cab, and no cab driver will stop for him. And any Tehrani will tell you, mullahs are not cab drivers' favorite customers. And it's not unusual to be with some crazy driving cab driver who will wind down the window when he sees some poor innocent mullah minding his own business on the side of the road and will start shouting out at him, blaming every ill in the country on the clerics. So in this scene, when the scene happened, I was in the cinema, and the cinema erupted into applause and cheers, into hoots of laughter. And I wrote about it. Actually, I began my article, "Have you heard the one about the mullah and the duck?" So I don't think that went down very well either. So yeah, Iranians love to tell a good mullah joke. So I was told that, yeah, those two things hadn't gone down too well, and keep your head down, and you're not going to be able to work for a while. So am I rambling? Were you going to interrupt me? So I decided to do something useful instead of, sitting on my backside feeling sorry for myself while all my colleagues got great stories and scoops.
Watching movies.
So I started to volunteer at a school in South Tehran. I had covered a story in South Tehran, and it was a school for street kids. And I volunteered to teach English. This was to children of Afghan migrants, children of prostitutes, and children of gypsies. So these are children in Iran who had no right to a formal education. At the same time, I had developed a friendship with a prostitute that I had met at the methadone clinic in downtown, in South Tehran. And she was a heroin addict, and she was HIV positive. And we had developed this curious friendship where we were fascinated by each other and each other's worlds. And she took me around her South Tehran, among needle-strewn parks, among the dealers and the madams and the drug dealers and the crumbling backstreet houses in the alleys of South Tehran. And these two experiences exposed me to a very different world than to the one I was living in North Tehran. And I would go back to my friends in North Tehran and would tell them of the people I was meeting, would tell them these stories. They're born and bred Tehranis. And they were shocked and surprised by some of the stories. And that's when I thought that nobody's writing this stuff. You know, this stuff is... this is the real underbelly of the city, and this stuff is so much more revealing than the nuclear crisis, than Iran's place in international politics. And that's really when the book was born, when the idea for the book was born.
So as you started to meet some of these individuals and sort of spending a little bit more time in South Tehran and sort of in the underbelly, as you say, how did you sort of gain the trust of these individuals for them to start opening up and telling you their stories? I think at the time that you were writing the book, being a female, being British or from Britain, and also being a journalist, sort of three strikes against you to some extent. So how did you, you know, break into and or really get people to open up and tell their stories?
Being a female journalist has only ever helped me,
okay,
actually. So either men don't take you that seriously, which is great, because they talk in a more unguarded way, I found. And especially with women, I have, you know, I can do all the stories that my male counterparts can do, but I can also do the female stories, which is, as you know, in the Middle East, it's really hard to access some women. And I had amazing conversations with some very religious women from very traditional families who would never have dreamt of talking to a man, certainly not about subjects like masturbation, which is one of the subjects that we covered. And some of the women were very frank and very open with me. So that wasn't a problem. How I managed to get in touch with some of these, well, I would not have been able to write this book without help from Iranian journalists.
Okay.
And many of the people that I interviewed were kind of part of closed communities. So certainly the crystal meth dealer, the prostitute. And that took time, and it was always connections. That's really how trust was developed. And where people were still hesitant and still afraid because they were fearful of being identified, I would show them my work, they would watch my work. For example, I made a documentary in Zimbabwe. It would have been very dangerous if anybody had been revealed, and they saw that I had blurred out, we had blurred out every single face, that we had not filmed one person's face. So from my work, they got an idea of how seriously I took their safety. So, but in the first instance, it was always connections. You know, Iran is this big, sophisticated, it really is a sophisticated, big, amazing, vibrant, vital city. And at the same time, it's, you know, classic Middle Eastern city as well. On so many levels, it's village level. It works like a village. So it's who you know. It's your contacts. It's my uncle's cousin's wife's mother. He sent me, you know, and they do a bit of checking. And who's your name? Who's your father? And once you have those connections, it's an instant bond.
So were you working undercover as you were sort of meeting these people, or I don't know if undercover is the right way to describe it.
No.
I mean, did they think that you, were you reporting on their stories as you were sort of collecting the stories, or were you collecting stories to write the book?
No, I wasn't working undercover as such, and I wasn't working as a journalist.
Okay.
Of course, this is journalism work that I was doing.
Right.
But I was very, I always am, this is very important to me, that people know what they're a part of. So I explained, I told them the title of the book. With all my characters, we discussed lies, how people lie, how they lied, why they think that we lie. So they knew everything, and that's really important to me, always, no matter what story I'm doing. So in the first instance, they can make a decision based on all the information I give them and based on the book and what I'm doing. Do they want to be a part of this or not?
So what they want to tell you and how willing they are to open up.
Yes.
To not only sort of their stories, but also connect you with some of their friends as well.
Yes. I mean, I you know, some people were very fearful. So you ask if I was working undercover. Well, no, what I was doing was being very careful to protect people.
Okay.
Is what I was doing. It was always the people's safety of the, you know, it was the safety of the people who were helping me and the people who were talking to me. And some, they wouldn't have just been in trouble with the law if they were identified, but trouble with their family, for example.
Got it. The book opens with a character, Dariush, who's an idealistic 20-something Iranian exile, I guess, growing up in Virginia, who joins a militant opposition group to impress his girlfriend. He returns to Tehran on an assassination mission, which goes terribly wrong. You start the book with a story like that, but then you end the book with your character, and please say her name.
Farideh,
who is an older woman. She's widowed, sort of a socialite living in northern Tehran, mm-hmm. Who leaves Tehran with the intent to sort of live in London, only to find that life away is not what she thought, and returns back to Tehran after 2 months. You know, sort of the interesting bookends to me of characters, you know, sort of tell us a little bit about, you know, the start and end of your book with these two characters, and maybe what you were trying to achieve in telling the stories, these two stories, for that purpose.
Well, Dariush's story, I mean, there were elements of it. When he was telling me his story, I related to so much of what he was telling me. Like me, he'd lived outside the country for many years, and he'd returned. And it was funny,
when he spoke about that feeling, of what it was like returning to his motherland after all these years, and how he felt, and how he felt connected to his land and his people, I really could relate to him. His story is a political thriller in a way. It's an exciting, extraordinary tale. And it's also like a comedy of errors. I laughed a lot, even though it's very serious and terrible. When he told me this story, you can't help but laugh. So with his story, his story was perfect intro, because it is the journey of the exile to Iran. And it also, through his story, you learn about the distant groups and the Mujahideen.
Right.
And it was a vehicle for me to introduce basic history and background of Iran. So his was the perfect intro, actually, his arrival into Tehran. With Farideh, I also related to her story, and I think so many exiles do. Farideh, great life in Tehran, but she goes to a few parties, they get busted, she starts to have a hard time, and you know, these things in Iran are cyclical. You can live a great life in your North Tehran bubble and nothing happened to you. And every now and again, you can get unlucky, and you can be at a party that can get busted. And Farideh just feels worn down by it all and wishes that she had left when all her friends had left for Tehranjali's and for London and New York and Paris. And she's been battling for the family money. And it's another classic exile, story of an exile. And of course, she goes to London, and life is difficult. She doesn't have the same wonderful life she has. And it's that pull. And in the end, she realizes that her home, where she really wants to be, is Tehran. And she returns.
And so as she returns, is she hopeful? I mean, to me, the book ends in sort of this hopeful, sort of okay, things are okay as they are, despite sort of the extremes of these stories that you tell in the book. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, are people just sort of resigned that Tehran today, Iran today, is what it is, and there's a lot of good despite sort of maybe some of the bad or the stories that you've told us in the book?
Well, certainly what I wanted to do with the book was to show that Iran is not a monolith, that, you know, not all people share the same ideas and the same hopes for the future. And the revolution was very good for some, you know, for a big part of society. That the revolution, that the regime serves a big group of people very well. And there are some who are happy with the status quo. And I wanted to show that, you know, Tehran isn't kind of the black and white, two opposing groups, crazy fundamentalists on one side, and just, you know, rich, secular Shahs of Sunset type Iranians on the other, that there are all these layers in between. So, you know, when people ask, what do Iranians want? Well, that's it's a complicated answer. What I have seen over the last 10, 11 years of working, living, and reporting there is a change. It, generally, of course, these things are anecdotal. Based on the people I have spoken to from across the board, what I have seen is a change and a shift in what they want. And it's interesting. And I find that more and more Iranians are becoming united in what they want for the future. And it is not Western intervention. So I think Iranians 10, 11 years ago, there would have been some Iranians who would have been more open to this. Or there would have been Iranians who would have been more open to talks of revolution, revolt, uprising. But Iranians, first of all, saw what happened after the 2009 protests. That were quite fiercely crushed. They've seen what's happened to the Arab Spring. They look at the countries around them, and they're really fearful of what may happen. So, yes, there is maybe a feeling of resignation, but there definitely is a shift in that people, generally, many people believe that change should come from within, and that will probably happen slowly over time. But the wonderful, exciting thing about Iran is that you can never predict it. But definitely, I've noticed that across the board, many Iranians are increasingly feeling that way.
that change is inevitable, but it'll be a slower path, perhaps?
That it should come from within.
From within.
Yes, that it should be determined by Iranians, that there should not be a dramatic uprising or overhaul or overthrowing. No, they're scared of that. Yeah, they gently, one step at a time.
But do you see, and maybe it's sort of my view in reading the book and sort of the characters, and while you talk a lot about the contradictions, to me you paint a little bit of a sort of these extremes. So, and maybe it's a little bit of an over the top or Tehran gone wild a little bit, or of people acting out and expressing themselves and sort of adopting a way of life, prostitution, operating crystal meth labs and the like, that, and still able to sort of function and sort of get by in society. With these extremes, and maybe sort of perhaps there's tolerance even for the government seems to sort of let it happen to some extent?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I chose extraordinary stories. So, you know, I heard extraordinary stories, and I wanted to really get people interested.
Right.
And I wanted to share some of these extraordinary stories, and some of them are, you know, some of the protagonists are pretty ordinary people, but they're just living on the margins of society, or they're forced to live extraordinary lives just as a result of the environment, oppressive environment in Iran. But I did want to tell these stories that were representative. I didn't want to shy away from what you're saying is kind of the crazier side. And while they're extraordinary, the stories are really representative of how people live their lives. So you mentioned prostitution. Well, that's a big problem in Iran. It's a big problem in Tehran. It's been endlessly debated. It has been debated quite a lot in parliament. I think the official figure of prostitutes in Tehran is 300,000. Of course, that's probably an underestimate.
Wow.
You talk about drugs. Drugs is also a very big problem. I think Iran has one of the highest levels of drug addiction in the world, and crystal meth has recently overtaken heroin to become the second most popular drug after opium. So, you know, these are definitely social issues that Iranians live with, and I didn't want to shy away from them. And in fact, they're inescapable. If you go down to South Tehran and you want to tell someone's story, you know, you are going to get somebody who's involved with drugs. You're going to get somebody who has used the services of a prostitute, knows a prostitute, is a prostitute. It's reality.
Do you, you know, let's maybe stay on the topic of sex and prostitution. Are attitudes changing in the country as the younger generation seems to find it as a way, or using sex or premarital sex or sex outside of marriage as a way to rebel? Are attitudes changing?
Definitely, they are. And I sense I wouldn't go so far as to say a sexual revolution, of course, but definitely a sexual awakening. In Iran. Across the board, it was fascinating talking to young Iranians about their sex habits. So it's still unacceptable to be to not be a virgin before marriage. In most of Iranian society, actually, I met some really kind of urbane, Western-educated Iranian guys who have girlfriends, and you wouldn't for a minute think that they would want to marry a virgin, but they do. It was really incredible. Well, first of all, kind of the slightly older generation, how they dealt with that. So, I mean, they've got all sorts of ingenious methods, including virginity kits, made-in-China virginity kits that you can buy from the bazaar. Capsules filled with red-coloured liquid. Doctors who sew up hymens, and I met girls who'd had their hymens sewn up. But what is happening among the younger generation, kind of late teens and early 20s, is that many of them said that only in sex did they feel truly free, that they felt as though they had ultimate control over their bodies, and that in a way it was their form of protest. And that I also found, that was not among the religious traditional families, although I did speak to girls from religious traditional families who were pushing the boundaries in their own way. So there is this definitely something rising up, but that I found across the board, actually, not just, we're not talking posh, rich Iranians, you know, really middle class and lower middle class Iranian teenagers.
And it even seems like there's ways to get around it with the view of, or the ability to have a temporary marriage. And tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. Oh, one of my favorite things.
I love this.
So you can get married for 5 minutes to however long it takes, to 99, up to 99 years. And actually, you know, a few years ago, somebody suggested in Parliament, it's a Shia thing. It's called, yeah, it's like Islamic Shia pragmatism at its best. It's like a quickie with an Islamic seal of approval. several years ago, I think it, about 10 years ago, I can't remember when, somebody in Parliament suggested temporarily marrying a punter to a working girl, to a prostitute, in, I guess it would be like a state-sanctioned brothel. So it would be having a cleric on hand. So the union, for however long they temporarily married, you'd like to think it was more than 5 minutes, would be state-sanctified, and it would be acceptable in the eyes of God. That was, thank God, thrown quickly out of Parliament as a suggestion. But what is happening with temporary marriage? So really, temporary marriage has been considered quite old-fashioned, and it's kind of looked down on. And usually, you know, the connotations of temporary marriage are kind of dirty old man with a concubine, and it's his way of course, it's weighted towards the man. So the man, for temporary marriage, the man can be married, and the woman cannot be married, and he can have as many temporary marriages as he likes, and he can end it whenever he likes. So the reputation it has is usually of kind of guys wanting to fool around or wanting to have a concubine and wanting to do it legally and in the eyes of God. But now what's happening, which is also interesting, is that I met more and more young people who were getting temporarily married so they can either live together or, more commonly, so they could travel around Iran together and stay in hotels together, because you can't stay in a hotel if you're unmarried in Iran. And I traveled around the country last year. I spent a lot of time, quite a few months, in Iran. And I spent a month traveling around the country and met many young couples who had got temporarily married so they could go on holiday, they could travel.
And so one of your characters, Layla, who is a prostitute, and has her temporary marriage certificate, I guess, or piece of paper. Do you think for her it was a way to also help her reconcile the lifestyle that she was leading, or was it just, you know, the get out of jail free card?
No, with her it was different. She bought that temporary marriage certificate. You don't need to. You're not normally given a certificate, but if you want to travel around the country, or if you are scared that you are going to be caught with a man that you're not related to, you can have a certificate issued. And Layla and quite a few prostitutes that she knows paid rather disreputable cleric to issue these certificates. So he was charging a fortune, and he was issuing these certificates illegally to prostitutes. So as protection. So in case they were caught by the police, if they caught with a customer, they would pretend that they had been temporarily married.
We have a question from the audience that sort of asks, you know, why does the government sort of tolerate drugs and prostitution and sort of some of these bad things, if you will, or do they really tolerate it?
Well, this is, you know, another contradiction of Iran and Iranian life. That Iran actually has some quite liberal drug rehabilitation programs. You know, it has methadone clinics, it has needle exchange programs. Certainly, I went to a center in South Tehran where they were, this is a few years ago, they were giving out condoms. They have recently opened a crystal meth rehabilitation center. There is Alcoholics Anonymous in Iran. There are NA meetings in Iran. And as with prostitution, as we discussed, you know, it's not something that they shy away from. So most of my facts and figures in the book are official statistics. I used a lot of newspapers for research. I used a lot of articles. There are Iranian public awareness campaigns to do with drugs. They're quite open discussing it. And sorry, I skipped with prostitution. This has also, as we said, been discussed in Parliament. Actually, right. The most recent idea was that a reform camp should be opened for women, where they could be reformed. But that has also been thrown out of Parliament.
Interesting. We talked a little bit earlier about sort of that red line, if you will, and crossing that red line, and you crossed the red line early on for talking about human rights or a movie. You know, I'm sort of curious, in writing this book, have you officially crossed all of the red lines, and maybe talk a little bit more about, you know, what those red lines are today?
Well, not as far as I know. And, you know, there isn't anything in my book that isn't discussed in Tehrani society, Iranian society, that hasn't been in the Iranian newspapers. You know, it may seem shocking to an outsider, but topics like sex and prostitution, there is a certain degree of openness in discussing them. As I said, I used Iranian newspapers for research. I used Iranian official stats, facts and figures. I also, you know, of course everything is politicized in Iran, but this is not a book about politics. It is not critical of the government. It's very neutral. It is just telling the stories of people I met.
Sort of on that topic, do you think sort of culturally Iranians are struggling with westernization versus modernization? So we talked a little bit about sort of these Western attitudes, maybe some liberalization or sort of aspirational. Do you think sort of Tehranis or Iranians see a distinction between modernization versus westernization?
I mean, I think, yeah, the kind of clash of modernity and tradition, you know, you see it at play. And yes, of course, that is a part of society and of a kind of developing, emerging nation as like Iran. And I think certainly the internet has opened Iran up. But what in respect to how it affects kind of everyday Iranians? It depends what part of town you come from. It depends what group you are. You know what group you belong to. You know, I guess some people are very resistant to westernization, not modernization. So yeah, I was saying Iran is a really sophisticated city. It doesn't feel like you're in a really oppressive, medieval, terrible, you know, fundamentalist Islamic place. You can live a really great life there. But yes, there are people who don't want Iran to be westernized, who resist all attempts at westernization and see Western influence as immoral. And of course, there are Iranians that push for it. But you know, it's the constant conflict that is in much of the developing world, especially when there is globalization on this level, and the internet.
Your stories paint a picture of society in which women or the role of women really haven't made much progress. Do you see things changing for women? Do women as a whole want more social reforms for themselves and just for Iranians in general?
Yeah, I think Rouhani made all the right noises about what he wanted for women and the status of women in Iran. And sadly, I don't think anything has changed. I think recently, was it last week, the chief of Tehran's Public Spaces, I can't remember what his exact title is called, has just announced he wants to pass a law banning all women from working in coffee shops in Iran. Women have just recently been banned from watching volleyball games at Azadi Stadium. A British-Iranian woman has been imprisoned for protesting this ban of watching volleyball. Leggings have just been discussed in Parliament as a
wearing
crime
leggings.
Against immorality.
Wearing leggings.
Not as a crime against fashion, which of course, maybe that
evil.
Would be yeah, a conversation worth having. But no, so things haven't changed for women. And what's interesting is, as well, that, again, the contradictory nature of Iranian society. So on one hand, Iran has a there are more Iranian women at university. I can't remember the figures. I think it's 60% of people at university are women. So the more university educated women than men in Iran. However, how does this translate into real jobs? It doesn't. In fact, what was interesting is that many women that I met from traditional families told me that the only reason they'd gone to university is because it helped their marriage prospects. It made them look better on paper. Having said that, there are amazing women's groups in Iran who are doing fantastic work, some of whom are in or out of prison, who protest for equal rights. And really, they're the bravest of the brave. And they push and they push and they push.
So do you see views, I mean, in the book, I think there's some contrasts as well around even sort of generational changes for women, views on divorce and being a little bit more acceptable to get a divorce, a younger girls getting divorced, having careers or even sort of the prospect of even living on their own versus living with their parents or living with their husbands or others. Will we see a little bit more of that change?
Well, divorce has, I think, God, has it doubled, tripled? I mean, it's really increased in Tehran in the last 10 years. And attitudes to divorce are really changing. So I met Iranians in kind of deepest, darkest South Tehran who still kind of whisper the word divorce. But now they know somebody in the street who's had a divorce. As opposed to 10, 15 years ago, when nobody in that neighborhood would dream of having a divorce. And compare this to somewhere in North Tehran where, you know, in one street you might be lucky to find, you know, married couple who haven't yet, who aren't on their second marriage. Definitely attitudes are changing, and that's another contradiction as well. You know, women's rights, and yet it's perfectly acceptable in so much of Iranian society to get a divorce.
We saw that in one of your characters as well, Samaye.
Yeah.
Well, you know, her parents or her mother was supportive of her daughter getting in divorce and allowing her to be divorced. She wasn't necessarily keen on herself getting divorced from her husband who, you know, she finds out is traveling to Thailand and doing all sorts of bad things there. So, and she, you know, she sort of stays with him in the end. So, you know, sort of that generational changes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so Samaye as a character, she's very religious young Iranian woman. She wears the chador. She loves the supreme leader. She cries whenever he's on telly. She supports the regime wholeheartedly. She will vote for whoever she thinks the supreme leader will want her to vote for. She's a great girl. We bonded. We're obviously very different. She wears her skinny trainers, her skinny jeans and her Converse trainers, and she's got, you know, multiple ear piercings. You know, she's a cool chick. She wears Mango, Zara, Benetton
right.
under her chador. And she's, yeah, but her world is very, very different to to the North Tehran group and to much of middle class Iran. Yet she's a really strong woman, even though she can be very judgmental about the place of women in society. But she's had a transformation. She would never have dreamt of getting divorced, and she was in a situation where she had to consider it. And her mother, who would never have dreamt of recommending that her daughter get divorced, told her daughter to get a divorce. And it's really interesting what's happening in Sumaya's world and how Sumaya's world is opening up in its own way.
Talk a little bit more, though, about her story, because I was also taken, sort of liked her story in that, as you said, she sort of represents those contrasts, the way she dresses, you know, wanting to go to university, but then not going to university to please her husband, who, by the way, is her first cousin, as, you know, and she thinks that she's done okay for herself by marrying sort of...
Yeah, so first of all, marrying your first cousin isn't as shocking as it sounds. I have a friend who's married to her cousin, so that's not shocking in Iran, and it's acceptable. He did happen to be her cousin, but that's done. You're not from, especially in kind of her world. She wasn't brought up with him as her brother. You know, he was a virtual stranger. And really, when she didn't go to university, so she really wanted to go to university. So she's a smart, switched-on young woman. She's very religious, but smart and switched-on. Wanted to go to university. Her father wanted her to. Her mother wanted her to. But the reason she didn't wasn't because she was, you know, because she believed her place in society was lower than her husband's. It was just out of love, actually. She fell in love with the wrong guy. You know, he turned out to not be a great guy. And that's how she... changed her views on divorce. That's how she came to view divorce in a different light. And of course, divorce is acceptable. You know, she goes on to find a fatwa websites. She consults find a fatwa websites. She has a moral conundrum or a personal dilemma, she consults clerics. She goes to a cleric. She will ask a cleric. You know, and she did consult clerics who told her, listen, if you were in this situation, this is not ungodly of you. This is not un-Islamic of you. You have every right to get a divorce. So she was not doing anything that was contrary to her religion. With her, certainly with her mother, it was really judgment from society, from the neighbors. You know, people talk. Divorcees are seen in their world, not in all of Iran, not in all of Tehran. Divorcees are seen as having looser morals, and she didn't want to be viewed in that way.
Switching gears a little bit, in reading and doing some of the research for tonight, there's maybe not controversy, but some feedback on the book in that the characters that you write are composite characters. Mm-hmm. And sort of you straddle between sort of your journalism and a journalistic style versus sort of writing a bit more fiction and fictional characters. Talk to us a little bit about sort of that using that approach to tell the stories and sort of why you chose, if you will, to, you know, tell composite characters. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the approach, and I found it, you know, really provided... it worked effectively to tell these detailed stories and very rich stories, factual and historical, but also really multidimensional characters. Mm-hmm. So maybe talk to a little about, you know, why you chose to write the book this way.
First of all, nothing in the book is fiction. I wrote it in a fictional style of writing. So I didn't want it to read as dry journalistic essays. I wanted the reader to really feel that they were sitting there talking to these Iranians. And these Iranians were telling me fabulous stories. You know, they were telling me stories of their lives. I wanted really the reader to feel that they were sitting there in hearing those intimate tales, and I wanted them to feel that they were smelling and seeing and feeling Tehran. That's why I wrote it pretty much as the stories were told to me. And some of the dialogue, for example, is verbatim. like the crystal meth gangster. I loved the way him and his friends talked and teased each other, and I just would just literally lift chunks of their conversations and use language to create the equivalent in English. Why I use composite characters? They're not all composite characters. Most of them are, and I tell you why, because I had to protect people's identities. I think in one case, I changed a story ending, and I'll get to that in a moment. But people were very fearful to talk to me for obvious reasons. And they only talked to me on condition of anonymity. So there were gaps in their stories. I knew their whole stories, but they'd say to me, look, I don't want you telling everybody about this bit of my life because, you know, my auntie might hear of this and she'll know who I am. So what we'd then usually do is that we would agree for me to fill in that gap by talking to either another prostitute who would tell me about her life so I could fill in that gap. Or, for example, I'll give you another example. One young man I spoke to, he's not a composite character. He is approached by a judge who was in the revolutionary courts in the 80s. And he has an extraordinary story. And he asked me not to interview this judge. And the judge's story, I mean, it's intrinsic to the story, as you know. I couldn't have written this without talking to a judge. But I had to honour my agreement with Amir, the character, to not talk to the judge who was part of his life. I tracked down another judge who had been in the revolutionary courts at exactly the same time. And I used his story. So it's a real story, it's a real man, it's a real judge. I melded the stories together. So everything that is happening in the book has happened or is still happening and is real. But for obvious reasons, right, to give a complete full picture, I used composites and I interviewed many people.
Like I said, I thought it was pretty effective and really telling the stories, and again, very rich and detailed stories. We have a question from the audience about cities tend to be more liberal and progressive. How much is an average Tehranian representative of the average Iranian as a whole? And while you do sort of also contrast Tehran with its neighborhoods and the differences between north and south, you know, maybe tell us your views on, you know, Tehran. Is it representative for the rest of Iran?
Well, funnily enough, some villages in Tehran, some parts of Iran have got a reputation for being more liberal than the city. Where, you know, I've certainly been to villages where, you know, for purely practical reasons, I'm not talking about sexual values now here, but day-to-day living, mixing of the sexes, I've been to villages where, you know, women are working the field, so their headscarves are going to slip. It's not a big deal. You know, their headscarves will maybe be round their shoulders and they'll pull it up again, but there's nobody telling them to pull it up. Their dad's there, their brothers are there. You know, they're wearing bright colored clothes, for example. I've been to villages where they still celebrate weddings together, where they brew their own booze, their own alcohol. But how representative is Tehran? Well, I guess you're right. Like any city, it's a world within itself, especially when it comes to how it's developed, especially when it comes to access to the outside world, especially when it comes to what the internet has done. I mentioned the internet before. I should probably expand. So the internet has had a really interesting effect on Iranian society, especially the gay scene in Iran. I spoke to many young gay men and women, particularly men, said that the gay scene had really been revitalized by gay internet chat rooms, hookup sites, you know, and actually among ordinary Iranians, I know several Iranians that use dating sites as we do now in the West. So things, yeah, have opened up, but yeah, how representative is Tehran? Well, I guess it's an island, it's a city, it would, yeah, like most like most countries in the world, capital city is always quite different.
Talk a little bit more about social media and technology, Facebook, Twitter, the ability to blog or get sort of different chat rooms out there. You know, is it open or for most Tehranians, or
well, as you
up
know,
and down, or
so sort of Twitter
the,
and
the government watchful eye?
Twitter and Facebook are banned. But Iranians are all on it because they use something called VPNs, virtual private networks, which, so your computer thinks that it's operating out of another country. So you can access all kinds of websites. In fact, you can go, you have these kind of fake Apple stores. So they've got the big Apple sign, and it looks like an Apple store. And inside, they've made it look like, the Apple counter. What's it called? I can't remember what it's called. Genius bars. Yeah, they make them look like a Genius bar, and they've got all the guys sitting there, and you can go and you can buy your VPN there, or they can install it there for you. Obviously, it's rather under the counter, but actually, people are quite open about it. You know, there was a queue when I was there of people installing VPNs. Most people do it at home, but yeah, you can go to these places and have it done. So the internet, the filter net, as Iranians call it, it is monitored. You do have to bypass it. I think there was, a few days ago, there was a report that internet speeds, there's been an order to keep internet speeds down. So it's definitely controlled. But everybody's on it.
Reminds me a little bit of my time in China and just sort of similar circumstances of just keeping things sort of under, or keeping the lid on a lot of social media, if you will.
Yeah.
Do you think that's going to change, though, as sort of reform comes about, or, do people even feel being caught?
No, I guess unless you're a political activist, not really. None of my friends do.
Okay.
You know, people go on all kinds of websites. Porn is pretty big in Iran.
Social media for porn, technology porn for sites. Porn. Yeah. And so the other side of the benefits, I think, to technology then. Of more
what,
of
porn?
A,
I think I disagree with you.
No, I'm just kidding. Let's switch gears a little again. And I'd like to know a little bit more about your story. You were born in Iran, but raised and educated in London. You returned to Iran in 2003, 2004, after, sort of 26 years away. You know, why did you want to go back, or what were you looking for in going back?
I returned after 20-odd years for a family holiday and knew that I had to come back. So I went back to work as a journalist in 2003. So as soon as I got my postgraduate, I wanted to be a foreign correspondent, and I thought I'd kill two birds with one stone, that I would launch my journalism career from Iran, and also really resolve my own identity issues, which any exiles here will relate to. And yeah, it was a very profound experience, starting from the moment that, for the very first time, I was in Iran after over 20-odd years. I remember my brother and I turned around to each other and we said, oh my God, everybody looks like us. This is the weirdest thing. I was used to looking different. And then everybody looked like my mom or my dad or my uncles or my aunts or my granny and my granddad. It was this incredible sense of familiarity. Like I was related to everybody, like I was at a massive family gathering. It did help resolve many of my identity issues. So I'd gone there with kind of maybe an over-romanticized idea of what being Iranian was all about. And I realized that part of me is Tehrani and part of me is a Londoner.
You talk a little bit more about sort of your experience when gathering sort of the information for the book. Did you, and again, sort of seeing this other side of perhaps a city that you maybe didn't really know to begin with. Really, what did you learn along the ways, along that way about yourself and really about your background and your culture?
God, I learned what I hope that if anybody will read this book will come away with, that there's an incredible warmth and kindness in Iran, and I felt it from everybody, from the most religious, traditional people to the most secular people, you know, regime supporters to dissidents. And this really is the overriding feeling that you get in Iran, and you get as an outsider as well. You're really welcomed. I learned that Iran is such a complex place. It's impossible to pigeonhole. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book, that it's not this monolith, that there are all these layers, that you cannot presume and you cannot judge, that you can be sitting there with a really religious man whose wife wears the chador, yet who believes the chador shouldn't be compulsory, or who believes that there should be a separation between the state and religion. And there are all of these different ideas, different opinions across the social divides. And that was the main thing I wanted to do with the book.
So you can't maybe make assumptions about a person's politics based on where they live or sort of their wealth or...
To a degree, as you can here, as you can in any country.
Their religion.
But then not.
Did you ever fear about getting detained, or other than having your press pass taken from you?
Yeah, I was in a few sticky situations, but I was very lucky, and I don't think my situations merit talking about, because I have colleagues who were imprisoned, and I was never imprisoned.
Okay.
And journalists have a really tough time there. I think at the moment, to put this into context, I think there are about 30 journalists at the moment in prisons across the country. So anything that happened to me is nothing, is peanuts, compared to what many Iranian journalists go through. And they're my heroes. You know, the young journalists working there now are doing amazing work.
Another question from the audience. How do most Iranians feel about American people, the American people, or America?
Okay, so in the same sentence, they will say, America, devil. Oh my God, I'd love to go there. There's such a long queue in Turkey. I don't know how I'm going to get to Turkey. They never give visas anymore. Do you know anybody that can give me a visa? So yeah, I mean...
Again, the contradiction.
Yes. So, you know, and also politically, I mean, it depends who you speak to. But, you know, sometimes you go to some of these big protests and, you know, they're burning the American flag and it's a bit lackluster and half-hearted. They're like, stamp, 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 here we go again. So, it's politics. So I think genuinely, yes, there are many Iranians, many people around the world who are very unhappy about Western hypocrisy, as what they view as hypocritical Western kind of foreign policy. I don't think that's confined to Iran. And I think there are many people who feel that. Generally... Most Iranians love America, want to go there, watch American TV. I think there was, what was that Angelina, Brad Pitt and Angelina film? The one that they're together. Mr. and Mrs. Smith. That was on Iranian, that was on Islamic, Iranian Islamic broadcasting. You know, that was shown on Iranian TV. They show American films. It's not North Korea.
So there is sort of not so much a love hate, but I think maybe as Americans may feel, given so many years, or our lens in versus Iranian lens out, of years of sanctions and all of that, and not maybe understanding Iranians given. we can't do business, or, you know, so limitations on how we can interact.
There's a real distinction between how, you know, Iranians feel on a personal level and on a political level. It's two different things. So, and they make that distinction as well. You know, I can disagree with the government, and I can disagree with American policy and then politics, but that's got nothing to do with American people. No, I mean, I don't think in all the time I've been in Iran, I've ever heard anybody talk badly about ordinary American folk. No, Iranians are far too polite to do that.
So talk a little bit, I mean, I think we talked a little bit earlier, and this will sort of be our wrap-up. I think we're hitting our top of the hour, if you will. You know, sort of the reaction here in the States to the book. You've been in New York, Los Angeles, mm-hmm. And here in San Francisco, and are going to stay in the West Coast for a while before heading back to Chicago and then D.C. So talk, you know, sort of what's the reaction to the book so far?
The reaction has been great. People have been really interested. And, of course, people have made, people have pointed out the similarities between America and Iran, that we're not that different. We're really very similar. And I guess in some ways as well, you know, we're two societies that are quite divided politically. If you're very crude about things, right, because we all know it's much more complex than that, we battle the same problems. We are feeling increasingly in our own ways disappointed with our governments. There are groups that are feeling increasingly disenfranchised. So I think that's been really, really heartwarming for me, that people have responded in that way, that they've picked out the similarities, and they've related to a lot of the stories as well. We're not too different.
Well, with that, I'd like to conclude our program for this evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Ramita Navai for this excellent discussion.
Thank you.